Srila Prabhupada ki
jai.
Srimad Bhagavatam Granth Raj ki jai.
Hare Bol.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Okay, looking at the last chapter for Unit 11, Chapter 29. So, in the previous chapter, we looked at how one can practice Ashtanga Yoga, meditating upon the Super Soul, Lord Vishnu, within the heart, or Krishna in his different pastimes, or the deity of the Lord, and gradually, by that meditation, develop a feeling of affection for the Lord, which gradually, you know, evolves into a mood of devotion, especially if there's association with the Lord, the association with the Lord's devotees. So then, the next question is one who follows the process of Sankhya Yoga or Ashtanga Yoga and then wants to take up Bhakti more prominently or exclusively, then how is that devotional service performed? And we can understand how that is performed chapter 29 of this third canto, explanation of devotional service by Lord Kapila. So therefore Devahuti now requests Lord Kapila to explain to her this path of devotional service, and she feels that that is the best process to cultivate detachment from the material world. So Lord Kapila replies, well, there are, you know, different varieties of devotional service according to how they may be influenced by the mode of material nature. And there's also pure devotional service, which is spontaneous, uninterrupted and unalloyed, meant only for Narayana, Vishnu or Krishna. And such pure devotees, they have no other desire except to please the Lord in devotional service. So then how the person executes devotional service from the beginning of devotional service, intermediate to the Uttama Adhikari, is explained in this chapter. That open book question 4, which is a personal application essay that you'll be writing, very dexterously asks you to explain mixed and pure devotional service, you know, with reference to the first part of this chapter, and how that may be relevant to your own spiritual life. A little bit about the nature of devotional service, especially the preaching aspect of devotional service. So, first of all, let's look at a comparison of Sankhya philosophy and Bhakti Yoga. Try and understand the relationship between Sankhya, which Lord Kapila is famous for, and Bhakti Yoga, which he's also famous for amongst the Vaishnavas, although that may not always be evident. So, Bhakti Yoga, or devotional service, is the basic principles. Is the basic principle of all systems of philosophy. What is the relationship between Sankhya Yoga and Bhakti Yoga? It's actually the basic principle of all systems of philosophy. Sankhya Yoga, of course, being the system of philosophy. Now, that all philosophy which does not aim for devotional service to the Lord is considered merely mental speculation. But of course, Bhakti Yoga with no philosophical basis is more or less sentiment. So, it's the basic principle. Without Bhakti Yoga in Sankhya philosophy, it's merely mental speculation.
It's the same as Jnanis, isn't it? Jnanis is speculating without
Bhakti Yoga. That's right. Jnanis, they're on the path of mental speculation. If they don't have Bhakti, that's right.
So, Prabhu, is it right to say that Sankhya actually should lead to bhakti, or is it?
That's right. It says, as Prabhupada says, it should aim towards devotional service, towards coming to the platform of practical application of devotional service and understanding bhakti. So one should, Sankhya should gradually bring one to having faith in bhakti and applying bhakti, like that. Mental speculation, of course, means that mental gymnastics, the mind is going this way, the mind is going that way, and then it goes this way, and it just goes on forever, backwards and forth. It will never really come to a conclusion or to an end. One cannot actually, there's a difference between the mind just going back and forwards aimlessly, which is mental speculation, and actually, gradually perceiving the truth more and more. So the more we understand bhakti means that the more we're gradually perceiving the truth through our mind and intelligence. But mental speculation means that they're not actually perceiving the truth, even though the mind is contemplating so many different philosophical aspects. They're not necessarily getting any closer to the truth. And sometimes the mental speculators may even, speculate about bhakti and not realize it as the truth. It's just backwards and forward. But Sankhya, or philosophy, is also important for bhakti. Because if one is performing bhakti, one does not have to perform, Sankhya Yoga or Jnana Yoga in order to come to bhakti. One doesn't have to do that. But if one performs bhakti, he should automatically develop a proper philosophical understanding of reality, as we're saying. Therefore, if one's performing bhakti and doesn't, derive a proper understanding of reality, there is some it means the bhakti that they're performing is being performed incorrectly, you know, or you know, insufficiently.
So it's basically acquirement of knowledge. It's acquiring knowledge, Sankhya.
Yeah, knowledge and detachment, automatic or concomitant, you know, achievements by one who performs devotional service. One doesn't necessarily have to take them up separately or first. One doesn't have to take up the path of renunciation or knowledge in order to come to bhakti. It's not necessary. One can directly take to bhakti. But if one's performing bhakti, those qualities should develop.
Hence they both go hand in hand, isn't it, Sankhya?
They do, they both go hand in hand. And therefore, you know, when there's bhakti with not a proper philosophical basis, it's more or less sentiment. You know, it's not quite bhakti. You know, there's some materially inspired emotional sentiment, which is inspiring them to act in a particular way, and it looks something like bhakti, but it's not. And of course, you know, this is one of the things that there is a relationship between these things, the Sankhya Yoga and bhakti. You know, sometimes even amongst devotees, or you know, especially outside of ISKCON, of course, but some persons who consider themselves Vaishnavas neglect these portions, understanding the relationship between Sankhya philosophy and bhakti, because they consider it not really, there's no necessary relationship. There's, you know, they don't understand the relationship. They don't think there needs to be a relationship between, you know, philosophy and bhakti. And therefore, of course, you get people who wrongly, you know, practice or they try to practice Vaishnavism, but they're not. They're practicing something different. So, you know, therefore, Bhaktivinoda Thakur identified 13, you know, principal deviation movements from those who properly understand the philosophical basis of devotional service. So according to, you know, various philosophical misunderstandings, there can be all sorts of deviations which become whole movements. So, you know, it's quite significant. It's a significant point.
Where can we get the 13 elements if we want to?
Bala Bala, Saki Bedi, Sahaja, there's, you know, there's a book by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, what's that called? Bala Gita. I think it's called The Song of a Madman or something. But you know, there are a couple of books out by Srila Bhaktivinoda. I think ISKCON has published one or two books which describe Bhaktivinoda Thakur's a discussion on those points. Yeah. And Srila Prabhupada mentions it in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And, you know, of course, we were discussing literally this morning in class, you know, as our movement expands, you know, I mentioned about a month ago that it's actually, you know, when in the initial stages of ISKCON, you know, there was a clear distinction. These people are against us and these people are for us. You know, it was very clear. And it was sort of, in one sense, although it's actually harder now, because the people who are sometimes against our philosophy are, you know, very friendly to us. They're part of our congregation. Sometimes they even take initiation. And it takes some time before, especially when they start to become prominent, that you know, where they actually differ strongly against ISKCON understanding and mood becomes prominent. And it can cause all sorts of difficulties. You know, Srila Prabhupada had a few incidences where some of his disciples developed a completely different mood to Srila Prabhupada and caused big schisms, you know, that Srila Prabhupada managed to sort out. But, you know, and then I was actually, just a couple of days ago, I was listening to a morning walk, and one of the disciples was actually mentioning that Prabhupada stated that himself, that actually that's, you know, in preaching, as you know, within ISKCON, that it is more difficult and a little bit more dangerous when those you're preaching to those who are friendly to you, but actually in one sense they're against you because they have a different philosophical, you know, understanding, and they'll challenge ISKCON stance on, you know, from within the movement. So now that makes, you know, these you know, the devotees that do the Bhakti Shastri, the devotees that do the Bhakti Bhai Baba, and those devotees who hear from them, they, you know, not everyone has the opportunity to do Bhakti Shastri and Bhakti Bhai Baba. And what have you, but if they hear from the devotees who have properly studied the books, they'll get the same understanding as well. But those who, you know, derive the proper understanding from Srila Prabhupada's books, it is extremely important for the to you know, protect the movement. You know, Srila Prabhupada describes that our acharyas, you know, literally, they're like guardians of this movement. You know, they literally guard it, you know, and protect it from, you know, and even in the beginning in Nectar Devotion, right, there's it's described how Sanatana Goswami has, you know, established the various principles of, you know, devotional service, and Rupa Goswami basing his Nectar Devotion on those, you know, rules and regulations, and in this way it's sort of, you know, protecting this path of bhakti. You know, there are many sharks described in the ocean, you know, many different philosophical who attack, sometimes within, sometimes externally, you know, and it's extremely important that we always maintain the proper understanding of Krishna consciousness, and as soon as there's some slackening in the proper understanding of Krishna consciousness, you will see that proportionately the movement will be infiltrated by aspects of mental speculation and sentimental following. But that, to the degree that we stop preaching or slacken our preaching properly, to that degree we will become infiltrated and compromised of that. And then once that happens, then it can take sometimes many years to undo that problem. And it's actually far better to just from the very beginning always make sure that the devotees are very solid in the right direction, you know, that we should take. And therefore we see that Janavi Mata, when she went to Vrindavan, she asked that Jiva Goswami, that, you know, there are many Vaishnavas throughout India but you please distribute these books of the Goswamis, which are based upon the Srimad Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita and the Shastras. You please distribute them, because although the proper sentiment is there, she feared that without the philosophical basis, things would deteriorate or not progress properly, even though they were very enthusiastic about, you know, Lord Chaitanya's movement. So she wanted that this, you know, book distribution be spread not just to others but to the devotees also, you know, to make them solid.
So, do we have such a problem currently in the front, like alleviation? Is it affected constantly our movement, or is it?
Yeah. There are different there's nothing unmanageable, but you know, there are things that are being addressed. And looked at, and it's almost a constant. It's actually almost a constant activity of ISKCON leaders to maintain the purity of, you know, sticking to Prabhupada's understanding of Krishna consciousness. That's pretty much constant. And wherever there's slackening, you surprise practically proportionally, you know, immediately, you know, the contrary understanding just comes in, you know, very quickly. There are all sorts of things. You know, from in everything, from how we worship the deities, the mood that we worship the deities, and the mood that we preach Krishna consciousness, and training of devotees within the temple, our relationship with devotees, a congregation out of the temple, our relationship to accepting money from non-devotees. How that money is spent, you'd be surprised how there is a, Prabhupada had a very definite vision on every aspect of Krishna consciousness, and each one of those can be a challenge. For instance, let's say at the moment we're setting up the school, and you'd be surprised, that. In one sense, we may do that according to practical needs, according to problems that we may have in the past, but our major focus should be what Srila Prabhupada, the direction he would like us to focus on. So despite whatever, the current situation is, or the past problems, or whatever challenges or finances, sometimes we take those as the overriding mood of, we'll make a decision based on this. But our decision should always be based upon what Srila Prabhupada would like us to do. Even if it's difficult in the beginning, Prabhupada always knew if you actually stick to the principles in the long run, only then you'll be successful, even if it's very difficult in the beginning. But sometimes we... it's interesting to watch, some of these unfold. But it's also interesting to watch how devotees sometimes go about managing these different things, paying, more some attention to Prabhupada's direction and sometimes not. And what happens is sometimes practically we can begin something, but if you can guarantee if we've slackened in Prabhupada's understanding of things, the problems will come. And ultimately, because if something is based upon it, I'm not saying that that's the case, but if something is based upon the wrong foundation, the Prabhupada found unacceptable, it will collapse. no matter how much money, you know, or manpower or what have you put into it. You know. Unless we base things upon Prabhupada's firm vision, there really is no sound foundation. So these things are, you know, they're there. But this is, you know, why we try to, you know, thoroughly, you know, like lawyers studying the law, you know, just as far as we can understand Prabhupada's mood and, you know, statements on everything that we do. But yes, these things are always going on. There's no doubt about that. This chapter I find to be extremely important, you know, because it deals with devotional service and being able to recognize that, you know, although there is a huge congregation, if we understand chapters like this properly, we can very, you know, immediately recognize that such and such a devotee is doing things in this way, which is in the beginning or lower stage, and we want them to come to a higher stage for their own benefit and also for to guard the purity of ISKCON and to make the movement of ISKCON more effective. The danger is if we don't recognize this, we just accept that or you're doing a service, I'm doing a service, you know, we're both devotees, and you know, I love Krishna more than you. Who's to say, you know, what's going on in my heart is less than. But actually here, according to Lord Kapila, there are distinctions that, you know, that someone may have very, very strong feelings, you know, I'm serving Krishna like this, and one might think, oh, you know, their apparent love for Krishna is, you know, here's someone else serving Krishna in a much, without so much strong emotion, but there must be less. So who, you know, and then there may be a challenge. No, we should do it this way. And the more calm devotee is, you know, doesn't appear to have a lot of emotion thrust into it, saying, oh, I don't think that's correct. How do we decide? How do we decide? By Lord Kapila's instruction that, you know, some activities, you know, in the modes of ignorance, you know, or passion or goodness, these things need to be, they are always secondary to pure devotional service. That devotee who is establishing the principles of pure devotional service, that should prevail. That mood of service rightfully overrides, you know, moods of service according to the modes of material nature. But in saying that, what we understand is that, of course, people come to ISKCON, naturally their devotional service will be in the lower modes, and gradually we help them to, you know, we don't condemn them, oh, you know, you're performing devotional service in the mode of ignorance, passion, or what have you. We don't condemn them. It's almost expected that they'll be doing that. It's very unusual if they're not. And we try to help them to move in the proper direction. And then if there's a challenge, I'm actually doing things better than what you're doing, you know, then we have to sit down and, you know, make judgment. No, you actually have to improve, not that ISKCON has the challenge. Like that. Then, in some cases, you actually get where sometimes in some temples where the temple president or, you know, managers may be a little inexperienced, a young devotee may come from another temple who's actually practicing devotional service on a, you know, they're understanding the more pure aspects of devotional service, and they may challenge the temple, you know, that you're allowing devotional service to be performed strongly influenced by the mode of passion. But so in that case, now if that younger devotee is able to properly establish by Shastra, then sometimes the temple may have to change. So that happens. So, you know, the Shastra is extremely important. Of course, you know, for most of us here, you probably won't. I mean, I've lived in small temples and I've seen all sorts of problems. It's a very, you know, it's quite a reality. There's a couple of temple presidents I actually assisted to have removed on the basis of the fact that their, you know, devotional service had become so contaminated by the modes of material nature that they literally, you know, it was literally a hellish situation for the devotees in those small temples, and they had to actually be removed. So, you know, these things. But what is the challenge? And you're just an insignificant little devotee, and you've got all the powers that be above you. If you have the strength of Shastra, then you stand very, you know, solidly, fearlessly, you know, knowing that ultimately, you know, if you're trying to establish Prabhupada's mood and mission properly, ultimately, if you do that, you know, in a humble, respectful way, that ultimately, you know, the proper improvements will be there. So let's look at, you know, what is a definition of pure devotion. Let me ask first, just, you know, ask some of the students, where they may have actually, you know, either personally some incidents which they think might be humorous or serious, where either themselves or other devotees have performed devotional service which are, you know, quite strongly tainted by some of the modes of material nature. You know, we don't have to mention names, but does anyone, you know, have any unusual experiences that they want to bring up or discuss or get clarification on?
But does it, when you say tainted by material nature, is it like performing devotional services is just for that purpose? And then once you achieve that, you leave it. That's not devotional service anyway.
Okay. Well, let's what we'll do. Let's move forward. Let's have a look at devotional service under the modes and pure devotional service, and then I'll come back to that question.
Pure devotional service is only one.
Yes.
Only one.
That's right.
All other ones.
There are many varieties. That's right. That's right.
Prabhuji.
Yeah.
You know, with the temple, you know, we see some. And they get angry. I used to wonder, really, you know. Now it's after reading Kapila Dev's instructions, and it's very clear to me. I used to think, you know, the devotees, you know, okay, there's only one level and all that, you know. That I never knew that in devotion service there are three modes.
Yeah.
But now, if you view through Kapila Dev's vision, you can see how it's being classified, you know. But here also we know, you know, to throw out a name that you might be knowing. Anything and everything, they get angry, you know? The temple resident, the Brahmins.
Yeah, that's right.
You know what I mean?
That's right, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. That's
why? Yeah, that mood is angry, you know?
Yeah.
Like Hanuman burning the Lanka.
Yeah.
That is all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Hanuman exhibited one security mood, right? Their mood is all the time, you know? Like Hanuman, angry mood. So this is correct, is it not? It's not correct, is it?
Excuse me. fact. It's surprising, you know, when you read it, you think, gee, you know, it's there.
I was thinking, this is too much. All there, you know, the Supreme Lord is there. You know, they get angry.
That's right, yes. Yeah, I've seen that myself. Devotees, even on the altar, and in one case, in the middle of the festival, with hundreds of people watching, just bursting out in a fit of anger over something totally insignificant. And they were senior devotees. Therefore, you know, one may question, you know, that that means that, you know, the general devotees may think, well, it's acceptable that when I become a senior devotee, you know, that's my mood of love for Krishna, that I'm just getting angry and you know, because I love Krishna so much and I'm trying to, you know, but, you know, it's not acceptable. In some cases, anger is acceptable. You know, anger used in devotional service, it is possible. It's something that's done when the circumstances warrant that anger. But if you get circumstances where a devotee is regularly short-tempered, that's different. That means that, you know, there is an influence.
So can you give an example of the first one, where you say the angry can be voluntary? What's the example, like typical example, so that for a better understanding?
Well, you know, for instance, Srila Prabhupada, Hari Suri, used to prepare a bath, a warm bath at Srila Prabhupada in some countries, and they used to put the water thing to heat the water up, you know, and turn it on with the electricity to heat up. No hot water coming out. You'd have to put the thing in, the radiator thing, in to heat the water up. So one time he forgot to turn it on, and I think Prabhupada hopped in the bath. It was really, really cold, and he got very angry, you know, very angry at Hari Suri. And it appears, it would appear that, you know, Prabhupada's, you might think, oh, he's doing this for his sense gratification or what have you, you know. But Prabhupada was, you know, training up, you know, if someone's in the personal service of the Guru and may jeopardize the Guru's health or what have you, you know, they have to be extremely careful. They can't be negligent. You know, if you're personally serving the Guru, you can't be negligent at all, ever. You have to be doing, and, you know, to make big, big mistakes. Another thing is that, you know, I mean, Satsarup one time, Prabhupada asked him to send a letter with, there was an inclusion, some other thing that he put in it, and he asked him to send a letter, and then, you know, he called Satsarup in later on. He said, so you sent the letter? Yes. And did you put in the insertion? You know, he said, no, I forgot. Prabhupada became really angry. He said, now you've made your guru look like a fool, because in my letter I said that there was an insertion and you've made me look like a fool. And he got really, really angry at him, you know, that because again, so, you know, there's an example where Madhavendra Puri, Madhavendra Puri, who was about to pass away from this world, leave this world, and he was in separation from Radharani and Krishna. He was lamenting, as you know, Radharani lamented for the separation of Krishna, and he had two disciples that sort of looked after him in those last few days. One was Ramachandra Puri, and the other one was Ishwara Puri. Ishvarapuri used to, you know, clean the stool and the urine and, you know, all the jobs like that, in a very humble, meek and mild, you know, just diligent first class service for his spiritual master, who was somewhat invalid, you know. And Ramchandrapuri criticized, you know, that you're at the moment of death, you shouldn't be lamenting, you should be fixed in, you know, you're supposed to be, you know, Brahman realized and, you know, above the bodily platform of life and what have you. And he chastised him. He said, you know, that, you know, you get out of here and I don't ever want to see your face again. Don't you ever come back in my presence like that. You know, very strong chastisement. You know, I don't ever want to see your face again. Very angry. You know, very angry. Because, you know, sometimes the spiritual master may make an exception of one disciple for the benefit of everyone else. Rupa Goswami banished Jiva Goswami from Vrindavan because Jiva Goswami tried to defend Rupa Goswami because some Digvijaya said, oh, I've defeated him. They've signed a letter. And he challenged him and you know, smashed him. And Rupa Goswami said, there's no place for envy and anger in Vrindavan like this. So, you know, therefore you leave. And for 1 year, well, actually, he just left. He wasn't going to bring him back at all. And I think Sanatana Goswami, you know, mentioning the qualities of Chaitanya, Jiva Doi, the one who is kind to the Jivas, and Rupa Goswami understood all. So he let Jiva Goswami come back. But Prabhupada, when he was in Radha Damodar Temple, he said, he was talking with one of the pundits there, and he said, you know why Rupa Goswami chastised Jiva Goswami so strongly? He said, because he was chastising us. The chastisement went through Jiva Goswami, because you can only chastise a very advanced disciple. Jiva Goswami, he could accept that chastisement very strong from his spiritual master because he was so advanced. But that chastisement was actually for us, that we understand how careful we have to be about, you know, manifesting anger and envy in a temple or in Vrindavan or in the presence of the deities. So that chastisement is for us. So, you know, sometimes anger is appropriate. But it's not that every time Jiva Goswami approached Rupa Goswami, you know, here's your breakfast. Oh, where's the salt? Get out of here. Don't ever come back to Vrindavan. Next time bring some pepper as well. You know, it's not like that, you know. That, you know, to be in the holy Dharma and to be, you know, manifesting anger and envy is extremely serious. And to do that in the deity room or in the temple with Vaishnava is very serious. So, and to, you know, be negligent in dealing with, you know, the spiritual master, it, you know, sometimes the chastisement has to be quite strong to send a message to the whole movement, you know, like that. And sometimes a guru will do that through a very advanced devotee in order to give the instruction to everyone else like that. So, you know, these things are there.
Sometimes, Prabhu, something that people do,
yeah,
which is most inappropriate, to guide somebody, like, you know, like, even initially when I was going into the office, very, very beginning, like, first or second time, I didn't know, like, I would take some drugs and do this, and, you know, I would be very, very chastised there, and I would really feel very bad, but I thought that by that I learned so much. So if you take in that way, like, you know, because for the sake of the Lord you're getting angry, not for, like, to satisfy myself or anything, for the purpose of the Lord to teach somebody the right thing, sometimes that type of anger we should not really take it as, like, you know, somebody is angry, like, because for the sake of Lord they are doing, not for their own enjoyment.
So that's a fact. You know, that's correct.
Yeah.
You know, and therefore you get the example of there was Govinda.
Yeah.
He went in to massage Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who had fallen in the doorway in sort of an ecstatic trance, you know. And then when Lord Chaitanya came to consciousness, he said to Govinda, "How did you get in here?" He said, "Well, I had to step over you to come and massage." And he said, "Well, why didn't you have your lunch?" He said, "But I would have had to step over you." Like that. So, you know, for his personal sense gratification, no. But for the service of the Lord, yes, that's correct. So that's correct. But, you know, we still have to consider that, for instance, if these things are too frequent, that it actually sets a standard that it's all right to do, and therefore young devotees, So the odd occasion, as we say, sometimes, and there's something very important, like, for instance, I think if a young, you're given the example of a young brahmani in the temple room makes some mistake, you almost expect that. I don't know that you would necessarily consider that that's, you wouldn't necessarily have an angry outburst.
There's a way to tell, okay, somebody might be doing a mistake, but there's a way to tell. That anger can be converted into a nice way so that they don't get put off. At the same time, you're achieving, you're getting what you want them to get like that.
Yeah.
So some people have that art, but not everybody.
That's right. So, so therefore the point being that when there is anger, especially sometimes in a senior, mature devotee who, we expect they, know the principles of what's pleasing to the Lord, even using anger, then we shouldn't just necessarily say, oh, that devotee's in the mode of ignorance, right? So that point is taken. At the same time, if it becomes too frequent, out of context, and in the wrong place, then we actually should consider that even though that person's been around for a long time, they seem to be influenced by devotional service and mother vision. So, these things are there. Yeah, that's a fact.
One day, what happened
to
you, because about the month ago, in the temple, when some devotees came from outside, maybe from America or some other part of the world. So they came and they were doing kirtan. It was 7:30, 8 o'clock, and 9 o'clock, and till 10 o'clock it went on. Then after that it was continuing after 10, like 10:15, people were saying, "Hari Bol, Hari Bol," then it was going on and on. And at some point, and the Prabhu, whoever was singing very nicely, undoubtedly. So it was going on, Hari Bol, Hari Bol. It became like 7:30 close to. At that time what happened, when Prabhu, he came and he was singing and he just took that mic and he put it inside. Then he angry like that. Then this Prabhu was, because he, first time he came, or I don't know if you guys here come here, I don't know. He was, suddenly he saw who that was and then he thought, then he felt very bad. Then after this Prabhu then kept it inside and he went and offered, okay, this Prabhu, whoever it was, offered obeisance, and then when he was coming near the door, that Prabhu, he just did like that. I'm really sorry, Prabhu, if I have done something wrong. Because this you can understand in so many ways, this incident.
That's right. Sometimes, has to be a degree of anger to make the point.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, if there's not, they'll actually, sometimes if there's a sufficient degree of anger, just enough, it's like a dial, a devotee should know how to turn it up a little bit where it's needed, turn it down to, that's a proper
acceptable,
use of anger.
Acceptable anger.
That's right, because if you don't have the necessary force sometimes, what happens is that it can lead to a major confrontation. In other words, a person may foolishly challenge someone that they shouldn't, but with enough display of force, they'll say, "Oh, I won't challenge," because it is anger, and that's better for them. So sometimes things do have to be stated, you know, very strongly, and you actually need an immediate, quick reaction from the people, you know. So that, yeah, that it brings to mind a story of my brother actually, that just, you know, knowing a person's mood. But you know, in the old days, they used to have those trains, the red trains. Maybe you don't know, but that anyway. They had handles, you could open the doors yourself, you could open all the windows, and they had handles on the outside. As the train was going along, we used to walk on the outside of the train, hanging onto the handles, and our feet were sort of just, you know, between the wheels and sort of just slightly under the carriage, and there was a rail there, and we'd walk along. And then sometimes you could actually take the light bulbs out. And when you go through the tunnels, you throw the light bulbs and they explode like what do you call that? Like a, sounds like a grenade, you know, big flash like that. So these are the things we used to do. But anyway, some of the things I can tell you about. But anyway, one time I was there, my brother was inside the train, and he just looked at me and he said, "Danny, get in," like that. But just the sound of his voice, usually, you know, you hesitate, is he joking with me, will I say something funny? That would have been it. I would have killed myself, because there was this metal girder that sort of went along and just slightly under the train, which would have just cut my legs off, you know, and he saw it coming. So he said, "Don't get in," like this. And I just picked up, and I didn't hesitate, half a second, but, you know, I understood. Yeah. There was enough force. Yeah. Don't joke with this one. Yeah. Do what you're told from your elder brother. That. So sometimes that's necessary. Otherwise, you know, you end up with a bigger problem by not applying enough force. But, so, you know, we shouldn't walk around seeing everyone who displays anger as being in the mode of ignorance. Good point. At the same time, if things are, you know, inconsistent, and, you know, that anger is not required and it has a detrimental effect, and sometimes you see that people may have been around for a long time, they're using anger and it actually has a detrimental effect which discourages a person from devotional service, you know, and makes them very, very despondent and misunderstanding the situation. So we have to be a little careful there that it's not being misapplied. Due to a person actually being influenced by the, you know, just they're very frustrated over something.
What if the person gets angry, but then later he understands that it's wrong and he becomes apologetic to the person, and this happens quite regularly?
At least you're apologizing. At least you're apologizing. Yeah.
I think it happened a couple many times when the person is totally exhausted and so they don't have any problems.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that was
understanding
this today. Okay, that other
person is
very tired.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Srila Prabhupada mentions, of course, that's one of the symptoms of pure devotional service, that, you know, it's uninterrupted. Mm-hmm. And Prabhupada mentions that in a few of his lectures and conversations that. You know, sometimes devotees who may not necessarily be on that platform of pure devotional service, when they feel that they've done enough and they sort of stop, he says at that time Maya will just jump on the devotee and, you know, literally Maya takes that opportunity. You know, we think, oh, I've done enough service, but, you know, you know, my mood, I can just, you know, slacken off a bit now and just sort of pull back. Maya will actually take full advantage of that. There's no doubt about that.
So are you saying that when a person tries to, there's no excuse for losing their temper?
No, what I'm saying is that, you know, those who execute pure devotional service, in general, they don't come to, they don't allow the modes of material nature to infiltrate them at any stage, whereas someone whose devotional service is not quite on that level, is susceptible by attacks of Maya, and that means attacks by the mode of ignorance, passion, and goodness.
The person is totally exhausted from lack of sleep. Is that also they say that you're under Maya? Mm-hmm.
What's that? Is the
person is totally exhausted from lack of sleep? So, do you say that you're under the
They've been serving Krishna,
yeah.
You know.
I'm trying to join what I said and then what you are saying.
Yeah.
That Maya will take hold of a person and like I said, if a person has been doing sort of due to doing even if they are doing balancing their outside work and devotional service and whatever and all that, and they're totally exhausted from lack of sleep.
Mm.
And because of that something happened, would you say that they are under the control of Maya?
Yeah, look, devotees on a platform of pure devotion of service, that means there's no influence of the modes of material nature at all during, you know, the stages of sleep, dreaming, you know, deep sleep, you know, or wakefulness. That's, you know, for the rest of us, you know. it's like that devotee, it was a Sri Kirti Prabhupada, come in at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, kicked him. Why are you sleeping? You know, why are you not a pure devotee yet? You know, it's Prabhupada. And, you know, I'm sure he was exhausted, but he obviously maintained his, nice devotional, respectful attitude to Prabhupada. He didn't wake up, what the hell are you kicking me for, you know. So, you know, he managed to maintain his respect and proper attitude to his guru, even then being kicked in the middle of the night, ordinarily. You know, so that's good training. Someone without that qualification as a devotee could actually become, you know, angry and even the problem. So, you know, a definition of pure devotional service given in verse 8, Prabhupada describes very succinctly in his purport that there's not actually a motive. That's the pure condition of the living entity. There's just no other desire. There's no other motive, no other desire. Everything else is zero. There's just, you know, the desire to serve Krishna, to please Krishna. That's the only motive. As soon as there's another motive, I was listening to a conversation with Srila Prabhupada a couple of days ago. He was saying that, you know, there are many devotees who come to ISKCON and they want to do a particular service. You know, that I'm a musician, I'd like to do music, I'd like to do this and that. You know, I'm an artist, so I'd like to paint. You know, I do gardening, so it says, as soon as you dictate like that to Krishna, even for service, it's actually sense gratification.
You can't choose anything.
As soon as you dictate to Krishna that I'm choosing, it's not your choice, Krishna, what service I do. I'm making the choice, and I'd like to be a singer a musician, because that's what I've always done. That's sense gratification. That's it. You know, that would come under, you know, what, the modes of passion, no? Some, you know, you want some personal result and level of personal satisfaction mentally and physically from the way you serve. So again, you know, actually when I joined the movement, I was a musician and an artist. And I was never given that opportunity. Even sometimes there was different things. I was, you know, never really given that opportunity. Basically, you know, from our days were filled up with just collecting, you know, because in those days we had to collect every penny. He didn't have a congregation that really gave you anything. We had to just go out and personally collect every cent, you know, to pay the bills, to, you know, distribute the books and like that. And, you know, after many, many, many years, I thought, oh, you know, maybe I'll try and take up some of the music that I used to do. And I was so out of practice, and I thought to myself it would take me, you know, too long, literally, to pick up from where I left off. And I had, again, so many services to do that I never quite actually, so I literally just, that whole aspect, it never really, you know, I just lost it, you know, it just disappeared. But these days, you know, if someone comes along and, you know, we generally try to accommodate them as much as possible, because, you know, they want to dictate that, yes, I'll come and serve Krishna, but I'll do this, I'll do that. And to a big degree, we accommodate more than what we used to do. Yeah. So
basically...
But that, you know, that's an example I was saying in class. You know, a devotee would say something to you, and that devotee had only been around for 6 months longer than you. And they'd say, you're doing this, and you just accept it, and that was it. You change your whole personality, your whole character. You know, you just drop everything, clean slate, yep, okay. I mean, I'm talking about devotees being in the movement for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. You talk about devotees being around for 6 months, they're giving you instruction, you just accept. He's a devotee, you know, and I'm a devotee.
But Prabhu,
on
the same
kind,
you read somewhere else in the Bhagavatam that a person has to be engaged in devotion, not a pure devotee of course, but a person has to be engaged according to his nature to be able to do devotional service.
Yes, so that's Krishna's decision how to do that. That's the guru's decision and Krishna's decision.
So it's not necessarily that if someone has a talent in music...
They may think they have the talent somewhere else, and the guru can see that they actually have a better talent somewhere else. When I look back now, I see the, you know, I'm very thankful that I actually didn't continue my previous ways. And it's a small price to pay from what I actually gained from having to, you know, go out every day to do something I really didn't want to do. That, you know, that actually, it helps to develop a certain tolerance and, you know, perseverance, which I wouldn't have developed had I just been allowed to just go along with my, you know, what I wanted to do. You know. It really sort of knocked a lot of my bad characteristics out really quickly and very strongly and thoroughly, you know, by just literally doing something which is very, very difficult and practically against my will. And, you know. But, you know, doing sankirtan, knocking on doors, talking to total strangers, has actually developed whatever little ability I have to help people understand Krishna consciousness. You know, that you can meet a total stranger, and as a sankirtan devotee, you generally develop an ability where you can just pretty much sum up that person in a few seconds, because in sankirtan you literally meet a person, you've got to sum them up and know exactly what to say, and within about 3 or 4 minutes you've got to get a result, open up the wallet and you give a couple of $100 to a total stranger. You know, that's not easy to do, but in doing that you can actually then apply that in preaching, you know, that you know, people, you can sit with someone from any walk of life and you can just immediately relate to that person, they can relate to you. So, you know, over the period of time, I've seen that, you know, my greatest love in Krishna consciousness is actually studying and teaching Shastra, more so than being a musician. And Krishna has actually developed those qualities through the services that he gave me. So we may come along and think, I have this propensity to do devotional service like this, I'm a musician, I'm that. The guru is trying to engage them according to their propensity, because that's the best way to But the guru may differ that, no, I think you should do this service because I see you have a propensity that you're not looking at. Like that. So it's better to leave the, not to dictate the guru or to Krishna, you know, or management, and to, you know, work with them. But, you know, certainly there's dialogue and there's communication and conversation, but, you know, a symptom of developing, having the sense gratification removed from the service is not to dictate to Krishna or his representatives what you will do even as a devotee.
So basically, it's you, how do you best serve, and you've got to be open to what's
Krishna arranges for you through his representatives is always the best course, and then you know that you're not acting for your sense gratification, that your only motive in that is for Krishna's pleasure. Mm-hmm. And that's a good, you know, mood to develop. And
you can still continue serving what you thought you were good at and also do other things as well. So
sometimes that happens and sometimes not, you know, it depends. So for instance, Arjun was, you know, asked to do, you know, continue what he did. Quite often that's the best policy, is what a person does show, you know, as Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, what have you, as their, talent, then to continue to engage them in that way. That's usually the policy. But sometimes it's not quite evident to anyone except Krishna and the Guru that actually the person, you know, wants to do the sudra work, but we see that they've actually got the kshatriya or the Brahman qualities, and they're probably better off in the long run to be engaged like this, even though they may not see it themselves.
Yeah.
Completely forget that other thing.
Because I was also, I'm mainly referring to what we do in the temple. I say, if I'm really good at music, of course that doesn't mean that I don't do all the services, but I could do them as well as this, or if I'm doing more of music, you know.
Certainly if time allows, yeah.
So that doesn't mean I'm doing it for myself, actually.
No, not necessarily, that's right. Not necessarily,
So my this question seemed like practicing talking to the person. So once earlier in one of the classes you had said the same thing in an opposite way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You had said that in our days actually there were people who were really very talented who had come.
Yes.
But they used only in one type of that's actually a misuse.
That's right.
So
yes.
So now you're saying that's the opposite.
That's right.
Maybe it is better to just do it this way. I'm not
going to try. No, okay. So I'll just clarify. Sounds like I'm saying the opposite, but it's not quite. But the Guru and Krishna, the policy is, it's actually better to engage people according to their sort of natural qualities and training and propensities. And for instance, in the earlier days, that didn't always happen. It was just one job. You know, you can go out and collect, liberate Lakshmi, or you can't. You know, and if that's the case, we'll get you to do the job around the temple. It was almost like a, you know, just therefore, that engaging people according to their propensity didn't really take place as much as it should. So that was not a good thing. So, then we appear to be saying the opposite, that a devotee is prepared to do any service and not necessarily act in a particular way that they want to. So, the point which reconciles the two is that the devotee leaves that up to the authorities. So the authority should be trying to engage people, the representatives of Krishna should be trying to engage people generally, as a general, in their natural situation like that. But the devotees who are coming along, that may not always happen, and they should leave that final choice to the authorities, the guru, to Krishna's arrangement, because sometimes Krishna may see that actually you know we're thinking we have a talent or we want to serve Krishna like this, but Krishna see that that can create problems, or actually we have a nature which is slightly different to what we know as of ourselves. So the reconciling factor is that
from a management angle you use people according to their talent. And from an individual perspective you do just what you're told.
So there are two perspectives. One from management, that they shouldn't misuse the management, they should be expert to try and engage people properly according to their natural position. Unless there's an emergency situation. See? And you know, in the earlier days there was more of an emergency situation. You know, if a devotee said, today, you know, I've got this ability to, you know, do kirtan, I'll sit it around and do the harmonium practice. We just look in disbelief. We say, okay, well, we won't eat this week. Alright? So yeah, you sit there and you play your harmonium and... you know, let's see, we'll just have plain rice this week because we won't have enough Lakshmi to maintain the and we won't serve prasadam at the Sunday feast. So, but yes, so there's emergency situations, right? And therefore, but what did happen and what can happen is that when those emergency situations go on for extended periods, which they you know, in the early days they did. But then the managers tend to think that that's the standard of how things should be. Even though the emergency's passed, there's sufficient money, there's sufficient for prasad, all the bills are paid. A devotees, some of them want to be engaged more according to their natural and they're saying, no, you still, everyone has to do this one service. But that did happen in some places, so that part was wrong. But you see, so that's why again the Shastra is important, because sometimes we start something for a particular reason, that cause is no longer there, and we're still doing it because, oh well, they did it before me for so many years, so I'll continue to do it. And if someone tries to change it, so oh, you know, why are you trying to change this one? You know, so. Shastra helps us to apply things because circumstances change. You know, we're always guarding ISKCON and expanding ISKCON and helping conditioned souls. The Shastra helps us to do that in so many different varieties of conditions. We can't just adopt one policy and do it for all time, and sometimes that happens. Now, talking about these modes of material nature. Now, when we did Bhakti Shastri, we looked at the Kanishtha Adhikari. And they're described as the neophyte or third class devotee, or one whose faith is not strong and who at the same time does not recognize the decision of the revealed scriptures. The neophyte's faith can be changed by someone else with strong arguments or by the opposite decision. So, neophytes. Now, when we looked at that, there was a nice quote we looked at, which is from a lecture from Srila Prabhupada on the Nectar Devotion, on that section, and he said this, that Now, Chutanantra is saying first class, second class, and third class devotees are pure devotees? Prabhupada said yes. So you have Kanishtha, Madhyam, Uttama. Are they pure devotees? Yes, a pure devotee who is anyone who has no other motive except to serve Krishna. It doesn't matter if he's first class, second class, or third class. Very nice quote. So, and yāvilāsita sunyam. If he has some motive, then he's not a pure devotee. And that's what we were saying there before, that, you know, I will dictate to Krishna, you know, in this way, that I will serve Krishna in this particular way because I have some motive to enjoy serving Krishna like this. Unmotivated, and Prabhupada quoted this particular verse when he made that statement, that anyavilasada sunyam zero means that my only desire is to serve Krishna. I will not dictate what service I will do for Krishna. Krishna will dictate to me how he will be pleased. That's anyavilasada sunyam. And one who has that move, whether they're Kanishtha, Madhyam or Uttama, is a pure devotee. They're practicing pure devotional service. They're being trained in pure devotional service. Even if they're in the green mango state, neophyte state. They're a pure devotee in the neophyte state. Now that is different to devotees who, because of the strong influence of the modes of ignorance, passion, and goodness, allow their service to be strongly motivated according to those modes of material nature. See? So in other words, someone may, it's natural that someone comes to devotional service, they may be strongly in the mode of passion with some, you know, tamas, ignorance, and they want to get a certain amount, they have motivations to act in certain ways, even as a devotee, in order for them to, you know, reap certain results, even while they're doing devotional service. They have certain motives, right? That's there. But if that same devotee then just says, but despite that, I'll just do what I'm, you know, asked to do for Krishna's pleasure, then that devotee who's influenced by those modes of material nature literally transcends them, even in a neophyte state. Even though those modes are affecting them, they're causing them difficulty, they're pushing them in a certain way, that devotee takes up pure devotional service. If that devotee, rather than, you know, becoming unmotivated, says, no, I'm going to serve according to my personal motivations, then to that degree they reduce their ability to actually perform pure devotional service or to be trained in pure devotional service. And therefore they may be mixed devotees for a long period. So sometimes you get devotees who can be around for 20 years or more and can actually, you know, very rarely, you know, take up proper training in pure devotional service because they maintain their personal motivations. So, the influence of the modes of material nature is there, but therefore Prabhupada, you know, describes that he says, we're not pure devotees, but if we act under the direction of a pure devotee, we become as good as a pure devotee. So, you know, even though the modes, you know, say there's some conditioning according to the modes, where ordinarily we would have some, you know, particular motivation in performing our activities, even though it's there in the heart, we put it aside and we just do the unmotivated service simply for the pleasure of Krishna's devotees. Although we're not a pure devotee, we're as good as, from the very beginning. So, you know, it becomes very hard sometimes to distinguish between those practicing pure devotion. Well, it's not hard if you actually follow Shastra, it's very easy, you can see as plain as, you know, daylight. But for most people who don't properly educate themselves, you know, in these sciences of Lord Kapila and Nectar Devotion, Prabhupada statements and what have you, they have no idea who's practicing pure devotional service and no idea who's practicing devotional service strongly mixed by the mode of material nature. And they make their decisions on who is practicing pure devotional service according to position, birth, the type of service they're doing, or this one's doing deity worship, they must be a pure devotee, this one's a manager, they must be a pure devotee. You know, that person's just cleaning up the rubbish. No way that person could be a pure devotee. They make decisions wrongly. You know, this person is cleaning up the kitchen, this one's doing it. If we don't understand that, this chapter properly, there's no way we can properly distinguish between one devotee and another. Who's actually doing things correctly? And progressing very, in the right direction. And of course, most of the devotees, as I said from the very beginning, when we start Bhakti Shastra and Bhakti Bhadnala, most of the devotees who actually do these courses, you would expect, will be guiding huge numbers of community members over the course of their lifetime. If those devotees guiding many, many others cannot perceive whether a person is advancing properly or not advancing, then how can they, where you get a lot of problem. And then what happens is that, sometimes you get leaders who people put a huge amount of faith in and have a very strong sentimental attachment to. Thank you. But they may sometimes be not properly cultivating the mood of pure devotional service, but actually mixed devotional service. Therefore, all sorts of problems will crop up later on, both for the manager and the senior devotee and for the community. And that leads to, eventually people become disenchanted. When that problem, hits the fan, people become very disenchanted. Oh, what this leader? I followed this leader, and look at this, the mess. Something very wrong with this one. This is ISKCON. These teachings of Lord Kapila. This is actually ISKCON. We follow. So therefore, we're following something else. It can have, and especially when you're dealing with thousands of people, hundreds of people, millions of dollars. In people's lives, they're making life decisions based upon what we teach them. These things can become very, major events. And therefore we find in many of the churches, Christianity, Muslim religion, Buddhism, they're crumbling. And people are having huge crises of faith. Prabhupada said even when he was here, practically, Christianity is finished. No one, in name, yes, I'm a Christian. No one actually takes it seriously, even the Christians. There may be some sentimental fanaticism here and there, but basically no one takes it. Because, there has to be a proper understanding of what is pleasing to God and what is not pleasing to God. That's the basis of all of it. And what is pleasing to God is where you do something for His pleasure that He has authorized as pleasing. And no matter how wonderful something else is, if someone says, "Bring me a glass of water," and you bring them a glass of milk, it's not pleasing. And the person may think, "Well, milk's better for you than water," and I'll put some, mint leaves or something in there as well, but it's not pleasing. If you ask for water, you just give water. So,
probably there's a difference in culture.
Yes, that's a fact. There's the culture of Vaishnavism, and there's which is one.
No, what I meant was, like, for example, if this happened in the Telugu society,
yeah,
they were saying that they were not receiving the guests properly. They may ask for water, but you're supposed to give water and also give them something else, but they will not ask. They may say no, 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 but they you have to force. Otherwise, that means they're not taking care. So there is a they will say no.
when we are
calling them for tea,
yeah,
and we want to give them something, some sweet, or they say no, but yeah, they're supposed to force it and give it.
Yeah, well, you know, but it is an example of how wrong things can become, you know, where something has an, you know, originally has a proper way of doing it, and then it just becomes something which is based upon fanaticism. And, you know, this is what we see, you know, in Hinduism, in Christianity, what have you, that originally there was a good basis. So when a guest comes, you know, we don't want to be in the mood that, okay, I'm serving you something, but, you know, and you give a little portion because you're thinking, well, you know, if he eats any more than that, I'm not going to be able to eat as much as I want, and, you know, it's costing me too much to feed this guest anyway. So, you know, so therefore it's proper to always be in the mood that the guest is feeling that practically as much as they want, you know, that's the basis of our restaurants. The Prabhupada wanted that in food distribution or even our restaurants, when people go there, they should have the mood that as much as they want they can have. You know, that's very unusual, but that's the Vedic culture. Now, so therefore the host is, you know, a little insistent, because they say you ask three times, you know, I'll take a little more. Oh, no, I couldn't, you know. And the guest is being a little shy. Well, I've eaten so much, you know, they'll probably think I'm greedy and have some more. But I really love that subject. I'd love a little. Take a little. No, I couldn't. Take a little. I insist. Please. Okay. Well, like that. So it gives a shy guest the opportunity, and then, you know, they're very happy. But, you know, where the guest is sort of, you know, they're eating and they're, whoa, that's it for me. And you know, the host is, no, eat some more. No, I couldn't. You know, I'll be physically ill. Eat some more. You know. Then it's become...
Next time they're not comfortable.
It's fanaticism.
This is one day of not
getting rid of
them. Don't ever come back to my house. You won't eat my food.
Instead of asking them not to come
back, you feed them more. Don't you ever come back. Yeah. So, you know, because what is the purpose of doing that? The purpose is that the guest feels pleased that, you know, I was a bit shy, I ate as much as I wanted, and I'm really satisfied and pleased. If a person is too forceful, the guest becomes disturbed. Look, why do you keep badgering me? You know, now I'm getting indigestion because I want you to stop asking me. then the guest is not pleased. That means that because they don't understand the very purpose of that cultural ploy, then we must follow the custom. You know, my parents did it, they did it like that. We don't care the guest is not pleased. You, Dad will eat. This is our custom. You see?
You don't understand body language.
No, you have to understand the purpose. You know, the purpose. The purpose is to please the guest. And the same here, the purpose of devotional service is to please Krishna. And as long as, if you understand that, you'll actually do everything correctly, even if you're not so expert. If we follow rules and regulations, and therefore in the nature of instruction, I think it is, that to follow the rules and regulations, what's the wording, without nimagraha, to follow the rules and regulations without the proper purpose is forbidden. You know, it's actually destructive of devotional service. It spoils it. Spoils devotional service. And the same, if you follow cultural rules and regulations for the sake of those cultural rules and regulations without understanding the purpose, you actually spoil the culture.
And this is where people have trouble with faith crisis and stuff, because in this book God wants us to do this, and in this book God wants us to do something opposite. So then they have trouble with that.
Well, not really, because you know if that they shouldn't, because the goal is to please God. So if you look in one scripture and you see that, oh, I can see, you know, this information, and you know we can please God like this, and you know, wherever you can get that information, you should take it. If you can get knowledge how to please God from any scripture, take it. If you can get it from the Bible, from the Quran, from the Bhagavad Gita, take that knowledge. That's
how. It seems that even maybe imagine conflict.
That's right, because they say that no, we can only get that knowledge from this scripture. But you know, if there is knowledge how to please God from, you know, anywhere, we take it. So for instance, in education, you know, one wants to get employment, and therefore one has to please the prospective employer, the boss, that if I come to your business, I will please you. These are my qualifications by which I can please you in so many different ways, like that. Huh? The goal is to please the boss, you get the employment, you get the pay, everything like that. When people take that knowledge, you see that they, you know, people from India, they get some knowledge in India. They sometimes come to Australia, they do education. Yeah, we can get that knowledge in Australia. Sometimes they go to Canada, well, we can get that knowledge. So wherever the knowledge is available, they take it. The end result is they know how to, but when it comes to God, they say, no, you can only get it, you know, they don't follow the same principle of knowledge. Knowledge can be taken from wherever it's available, you take it. You know, you're achieving your goal, pleasing God. But they don't do that because, you know, they're sectarian, because in many cases, the religious principles are cheating religion, where they're trying to monopolize the resources of the world for sense gratification. They're more interested in that than actually, you know, how to please God. So, you know, when there's some other motive there, then, you know, that you find that discrimination, you know, which is wrongly applied. You know, gold. If you drop gold in a filthy place, you know, if you pick it up and wash it, it's gold. It doesn't matter where it's been. You know, if a Muslim is holding gold, it's the same as if a Hindu is holding gold. If an atheist is holding gold, it's still the same gold. It has, you know, it has lost its value or become increased or decreased. In the same way, knowledge, whether it's coming from the Muslim, from the Christian, from the Hindu, or any, it's knowledge. It doesn't matter. It's you know, if that knowledge is saying that God can be pleased in such and such a way, then why not take it? Now we do, you know. One of the fourth offences is for devotees to blaspheme Vedic literature or literature and assurance of the Vedic version. Prabhupada considered that the Bible, the Quran, these scriptures are actually Vedic literatures. They're Vedic literatures because if they're where they're in pursuance of Vedic knowledge, then they're considered not different from Vedic literature. Because Veda means knowledge. Where there has been some, you know, malinterpretation that people have according to their cheating religious propensity. They've included things in their scriptures and taken things out. Then that's not Vedic, it's not knowledge or anything. So, you know, we may... But otherwise, you know, knowledge is knowledge wherever it's coming. Gold is gold wherever it's coming.
This reminds me of that book, Stephen Rosen, Diet for Transcendence. Because one big one's meat eating. Like so many religions, they allow it. But then we don't, and so they say, well, you know, God says one thing to you and one thing to someone else. But then Stephen Rosen actually draws from all scriptures that vegetarianism is actually required.
Yeah.
Christianity just clearly said, thou shalt not kill, and they just simply kill.
That's right.
Prabhupada mentioned that's why.
So, you know, that's where Srila Prabhupada says, you know, people can argue on scripture in so many different ways, and it gets very hard to, you know, discuss. But we can catch them out very easily is the fact that they actually just don't follow their own scripture. Thou shalt not kill, and they don't follow. Their business, their whole business is killing. Wholesale. You know, humans, you know, animals. So, you know, they don't follow. But that's the difference. So therefore, you know, as we say, as Prabhupada says, the devil is quoting scripture. That they may be Christian or what have you. They don't go to church. They don't follow any of the rules and regulations of the Bible. And yet, if you say, you know, Srimad Bhagavatam says this, they say, oh, well, our Bible says that. But, you know, they don't follow it. They don't have faith in it. They don't accept it. The devil is quoting scripture. So, for the, you know, just for the sake of arguing, you know, because arguing for the fact that, no, don't try to convince me to eat not eat meat, because then I'll have to give up eating meat. I don't want to stop eating meat. So, although I don't follow the Bible, or any real religious principle, I'm going to argue with you on the basis of the Bible, which I have no faith in. So that's that's the rascal. But anyway, you know, in many cases, don't bother arguing with them. Just give them prasadam, get them a chant, Hare Krishna.
So you say each book is pretty much saying the same thing?
What's that?
Each book would be saying the same thing? Bible, Quran, Srimad Bhagavatam?
Yes, we take knowledge from any of those sources where it's you know, proper knowledge that, you know, you're actually learning how to please God by, you know, giving Him unmotivated love through your activities. Anyone who's teaching that science, we will accept. You know, therefore, Prabhupada, you know, highly praised the Muslims that, you know, he said, you know, that at a certain time of day, when it's time for them to pray, the proper Muslim, they just drop down and they just, you know, put their head towards Mecca and they just pray. And he said, this is very, very good, very nice, you know, the devotional mood, you know, you know, they just no impediment, you know, nothing will obstruct them. So, you know, that they would do that, you know, very, very strongly. It doesn't matter who's watching, where they are, they're at work, they're on a train, whatever, they just stop. So, you know, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he looked at all the different four sampradayas and he analysed that, you know, the main wonderful qualities that each sampradaya has. So, you know, we are like that. We can see wherever there is proper devotional mood, then we will recognise that anywhere. But of course, in order to do that, we have to understand Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita. And the difference is, with our ability, is that we can also sift through all the cheating religion, which is actually contained these days in most other religious books. So we have a little advantage.
This Prabhupada once said, and that's actually it's true, but all that might sound dogmatic, that there's no religion but Krishna consciousness.
Yes.
There isn't any religion.
Yeah, but that's not dogmatic, because that,
it's not dogmatic,
that Krishna consciousness is found when the Muslims stop and pray to God. That's Krishna consciousness.
Yeah.
You know. That's right. It's the same thing that we're teaching.
But to an ignorant person, it will sound automatic.
That's right.
Although it's definitely not.
Yeah.
No,
that's
fine.
Right. you know, we may say that there's only one real goal.
Yeah.
Other things are false goals.
Hmm.
You know.
Yeah.
So, now, one devotee once questioned Srila Prabhupada, it's actually in Harishori's diary. He says, sometimes the devotees think that when Lord Kapila teaches there is devotional service in ignorance and in passion and in goodness, that that may mean your own disciples too. But then some devotees say, no, we're above that designation, it's not mixed devotional service even though we're neophytes. Right, so we've discussed that. Prabhupada says, if you voluntarily do not follow, then you fall down, that is in ignorance. So, then Prabhupada's questions that, you know, first of all, let him follow strictly, you know, he says, who is my disciple? First of all, let him follow strictly the discipline rules. And then Makanlal says, then he's all right, you know. And Prabhupada said, yes, he's above those lower. As long as one is following, then he is, you know, all right. Makanlal said, and Prabhupada said, yes, then he's all right. So it's affirming the same point that if one actually strictly follows Prabhupada in any stage of devotional service. He's actually considered to be performing pure devotional service, even in the neophyte stage. But if one is actually claiming to be a follower of Prabhupada, but actually doesn't follow Prabhupada's instructions and mood, you know, that person may be susceptible to the lower modes of material nature, mixed devotional service. You know, so it's that same point. That's the real protection of the devotee. Is that the question is not whether the modes of material nature may be there in the beginning, because you know most likely they are. But if one is just follows the pure devotee, takes their instruction, that devotee immediately takes up the process of pure devotional service in the neophyte stage. And is not performing mixed devotional service. Whereas if a person, Prabhupada questions, who is my disciple? If they're not actually following Prabhupada's instructions, and yet they're doing devotional service, they're actually susceptible to be performing lower mode of devotional service or mixed devotional service. Not pure devotional service, mixed. There are all sorts of groups, you know, that's right, that form schisms, and if they don't actually accept strictly Srila Prabhupada's instructions and accept Srila Prabhupada's conclusions, then even though they're performing devotional service, they will be performing mixed devotional service because, even though it appears very, very wonderful. So, you know, Prabhupada is, again, the same point. The focus is on, if you follow the pure devotee, that's the real criteria of either performing pure devotional service or mixed devotional service, a very simple factor. Otherwise, you know, and that's the example we give, where, you know, you bring, you know, I'd like a glass of water, and someone says, oh, I'll give him a glass of milk.
So they feel that they are
Yes, that they may feel like that, but it's actually been conclusively proven by the DBC, shastrically, by a multitude of Srila Prabhupada's statements, that Prabhupada did not ever encourage a ritvik system. There are just too many overwhelming statements by Srila Prabhupada. It is the very nature of the history of our Vaishnava movement and what have you. Therefore, the GBC, representing Srila Prabhupada's mood, his conclusions, his teachings, his instructions, that's what we follow. And if one, you know, goes against overwhelming evidence, you know, it's not that they're just making a statement. They produce, you know, you can get. There's a book which I read, you know, 101 refutations of, you know, the ritvik philosophy. So, you know, has anyone read that?
I've seen that.
Yeah.
Some part of it.
You can take every single one, you know, even ones that most of them haven't even thought of their arguments for ritvik, and it can be just completely smashed to pieces by Prabhupada's own statements and the acharyas and like that. So when there's so much overwhelming evidence, not like, you know, that your opinion might, no, there's so much shastra and statements, and they still don't follow, then Prabhupada questions, who is my disciple? Who is my follower?
So is it contaminating the to that sort of chant? Or we don't associate them with the deities and come back as okay?
We don't encourage them, and be very, very careful, because a lot of these different groups like that are very good at preying upon, you know, if someone is a little weak in their understanding or their faith, they are very expert in preying upon that, you know. And when I was managing the farm, there were a lot of ritviks in the area up there. They've all gone up north now. But some were actually living on the farm. The kids were all going to, some of them were going to the school together, so the families were interrelated and what have you. So you couldn't just separate yourself, because they were literally living on the farm, the schools, they were teaching in the schools and like that. So there was a lot of squabbling. So I decided that I would invite them to the farm and try and encourage that we would all work cooperatively together, and that we wouldn't criticize them and they wouldn't criticize us, which means criticizing Prabhupada and you know, criticizing, you know, very elevated devotees. We don't want to hear that. So, you know, it was like, okay, let's get the job done that needs to be done on the farm, but let's not hear criticism of, you know, our senior Vaishnavas and, you know. So we had a nice Sunday feast, and we did that a few times, and we were all getting along really well. And, you know, the criticism and the offences stopped, and we're just working together. However, I did mention it to Ramai Swami, and he said, look, you know, what you're doing is okay, but the problem is that in other parts of Australia and the world, they're so fanatical, you know, like, I mean, there are violence, you know, it erupts into violence in some parts of even Australia, that if you make it a real cushy situation for them, you're just going to fill this place up with the fanatics. So he said, don't. So I stopped. And then we just had a policy of, you go your way, we'll go our way, and they all went up north. But so, you know, you have to be a little careful, because, yes, you know, some of them are quite nice, but once you encourage a certain level of invitation, you've got to accept all the fanatics that come with it, and there are, you know, because where there's no, as we understand, where the philosophy is not there properly, you will get fanaticism, sentimentality.
Why do Prabhupada leave it like that?
What's that?
Why do Prabhupada leave it sort of hazy? Because he sort of didn't say, oh,
That's how they make it look. But yeah, you can have a look at that book. There's nothing hazy about the whole situation. All right.
I think in relation to that, Prabhupada Lilamrita, somewhere I read Prabhupada was nominating some of his senior disciples to be the next spiritual master after he left.
Oh, look, there are so many instructions for Srila Prabhupada. There's so many instructions. The Prabhupada is asking his disciples that, you know, you will be, you know, guru, you know, in the future. I will not be here. And you know, there are so many. He was expecting them to be guru in the, you know, and using the term in its just normal sense. A guru who accepts disciples, you know. In so many different ways. They argue, of course, that he meant guru in a certain way, you know, and things like that. But so many statements, actually, not just one or two here, there's so many statements where Prabhupada says that, you know, in the future, you know, I won't be here, but you will continue, you know, as guru, you can be guru. And he would quote Chaitanya Mahaprabhu from the, you know, Chaitanya Charitamrita. And he would say, guru, you know, it's not so difficult to become guru. All you have to do is everyone you meet, you just teach them that, you know, the Bhagavad Gita, the teachings, Krishna's instructions, Krishna Upadesh, just don't change anything. Ritvikism is changing things, but you know, there are many, many states. It's not just one or two here and there. But what they do is that they will misinterpret one comment to Prabhupada, and then every time Prabhupada mentions guru over thousands of times, they say that this applies to all those statements, that Prabhupada, therefore, when he's saying guru, but according to one little statement here, in every reference where he mentions guru, he's not talking about guru in the normal sense of the term. So you'd think if Prabhupada mentioned guru, you know, thousands of times, that he would reiterate, you know, such a big thing that, you know, but I'm not talking about guru in the traditional sense. I want to change things. In that, you know, it doesn't make sense. But anyway, if you read the book, you'll see how to whack the statements out. It's not hazy at all. It's very clear. But, you know, it's a good example of what we're talking about through the theme of this class, how, you know, in one sense, devotees, you know, we are all responsible to some degree as guardians of Prabhupada's teachings. And, you know, to this very day, there are so many different, you know, when we're not strongly preaching the correct philosophy of Srila Prabhupada, then immediately when there's some slackening, a force of you know, nonsense will infiltrate the movement, you know, very quickly, proportionally, immediately, to the degree that we, and that's what happened with the Gaudiya Mutt. You know, as they stopped preaching, the whole movement became completely destroyed. They stopped preaching completely, practically, and the movement was about destroyed completely by so many different schisms and fighting.
One time in class, Karamakana Swami was saying how when he was temple president in Vrindavan, he was constantly having to defend against all these, you know, this raft of misunderstandings.
Yes.
Philosophy in Vrindavan itself.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's a fact. It's a fact. So it's I was listening to a conversation the other day where Srila Prabhupada was discussing about the in Hawaii, some of his disciples, leading disciples, become sahajas. You know, very strongly, you know, trying to act upon their eternal relationship with Krishna as gopis and this, that, and the other. And there was a big conversation, and Tamal Krishna Maharaj said to Prabhupada, he said, Prabhupada, I always wondered that in apparently all your books, so often you're preaching so strongly against the sahajas, and I'm thinking, you know, why are you bothering? Because, you know, where there's a group of sahajas in India, you're preaching all over the world, there's no sahajas, you know. And then he said, now I understand, because this tendency to allow sense gratification to, you know, infiltrate one's devotional service is so strong that, you know, Prabhupada, you could perceive that it would come, you know, like that. So, you know, we in the books, we Prabhupada defeats so many, you know, the Mayavadis and the impersonalism and, you know, Sunyavadis and Sahajaism and, you know, atheism so strongly. And you will see that within the course of time, you know, that these tendencies are there within the, you know, the human beings, and at some stage they will, you know, become huge movements attacking, you know, ISKCON, you know, from one direction or another, because these are the natural propensities of the conditioned souls. Here we're discussing about devotional service and the modes of material nature. You'll be surprised, you know, like now and even in the future, how different devotees, even within ISKCON, who are strongly performing mixed devotional service, not pure devotional service, may actually, you know, compete for control of the movements, as to no, things should be done this way, and, you know, not in this way, like that. You'll be surprised how it will come down, you know, to a strong, you know, battle, philosophical battle, for the right to, you know, the ability to teach people pure devotional service, and not be overcome by, you know, because as the movement expands, and this is one of the things that Prabhupada mentions, is a danger. So when you expand the movement with many, many, say, mixed or, you know, materialistic devotees, the danger, it implodes. The danger is from within. So our movement like that now, it is growing, you know, in many places in a big way. That means that we get a lot of people in a shorter period of time, and mostly, you know, our you know, as far as training individually each and every person that comes along, you know, that may not be proportionate to how many people are coming. And therefore, you know, at some stage when these people become prominent, senior managers and, you know, in charge of the finances and all sorts of things, you'll be surprised how that can put ISKCON in a compromised situation, that they will have to, you know, there's also, you know, all sorts of things that happen in the course of time.
So how do we make sure that we don't perform mixed devotional
service? Just doing exactly what we're doing. Mixed devotional service means that unmotivated devotional service is we're doing service that pleases Krishna. How do we know what pleases Krishna? Through Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada's representative. Very good. So if we know that I'm doing things in this way, this is stated by Prabhupada to be very pleasing to him, you know, the proper way to do devotional service, either as a Kanishtra, Majjhima, or Uttama, then, you know, we're completely protected. And as soon as we're doing things, no matter how wonderful, but we're not actually particularly concerned with Prabhupada's mood or instructions on how, you know, we were given the example like a school, we're starting a school. You know, one of the first things that should happen is, you know, there should be a huge amount of research and documentation on, you know, Prabhupada's, you know, specific instructions on, you know, what can and can't be. You know, so there's a lot of variety that, you know, that can be done, but certainly the devotees should have that foremost in their mind before other decisions are made. it's not necessarily something which is up for majority vote. So,
so for example, like you're saying that you didn't behave to go and compete for the say a devotee hates for a particular service. Well, not hates it, but doesn't particularly like it. But he does it on simply because he's told that he should do it. That's pure devotional service.
No, he's doing it because he understands that it is something which is pleasing to Krishna and Prabhupada, the acharyas, and their representatives. So in other words, sometimes, as we said, that you know, we have situations sometimes in a very small temple where a devotee may not do what they're told because they consider that the instructions that they're given are actually not pleasing to Srila Prabhupada. I was in one temple where the temple president, someone gained $10,000, which was in those days a lot of money. And the temple president said, if you donate that money to the temple, I'll make you vice temple president. So what happened was this person became vice temple president, and all of a sudden, although he never really gave classes, he was then giving classes, and he was also stopped going out on Sankirtan. And in his classes, one of the reasons why he said that he should not go out on Sankirtan was because it wasn't pure devotional service, it wasn't devotional service, actually karma yoga, because you're going out and doing fruitive activity. So I went to the temple president and I said, you do realize what they're teaching in their classes, you know, and I explained, he said, that's alright, you know, he's going to give some donations. Anyway. You know, I sort of protested that, well, you know, I don't think that, you know, devotees should allow people to preach something which is completely bogus just so we can get money off them. You know, I don't think that would be pleasing to Prabhupada. That was my protest. So I had some heated arguments with that temple president. And what happened, of course, was that, you know, that person did give the $10,000, and then that same day the temple president said to him, so now you go out on Sankirtan. And he said, but, you know, I'm vice president and I don't want to do it. He said, you go out or you get out. So, you know, I didn't agree with that either. You know, so it's not, no, pure devotional service doesn't mean that you just do what you're told. It means that pure devotional service means that you're doing it, your motivation is because, you know, you understand that it is pleasing to Srila Prabhupada, pleasing to the acharyas, and pleasing to Krishna. Not that because your mind is right that you're just doing what they're told. That's not pure devotional service, that's stupidity. You know, if we just mindlessly do what we're told, you know, then how are we becoming thoughtful? Thoughtful is one of the qualities of a devotee. You know, but, you know, people have taught that, you know, authorities have taught that, you know, if you do what you're told, you're doing pure devotional service. And if you don't do what you're told, then, you know, you're not. You're a rascal. But that's not always correct. Sometimes things
do. If you don't do it, it's Vaishnava Prabhupada.
What's that?
If you don't do it, it's Vaishnava Prabhupada.
Yeah. That's right. It's sometimes, you know, the authorities sometimes forcefully, you know, force devotees to do some service which is not particularly Prabhupada or, you know, sometimes they can actually turn the community against those persons, you know, because they have that influence that this person, you know, is a rascal. And everyone's thinking, you know, it's like if I look at someone and say, oh, you know, you're a rascal, or, and I give a couple of reasons, you know, if you've got enough influence and what have you, people are not going to challenge. Not only they might think, oh, yeah, come to think of it, he has got the beady eyes, and, and there was this occasion where, they didn't serve me prasad properly, maybe he is a rascal.
One of the qualities that was mentioned of devotional service in the mode of ignorance is that one is envious.
Mm.
So when we feel envy, or when we feel that someone is envious towards us, how do we deal with that?
Then we don't allow that envy to influence how we serve Krishna. You know, these things are all mental. You know, they come into our mind, oh, I'm envious of this person. But you think that, I have no business, I've got some service to do which is pleasing to the devotees, I'll do that, despite my envy. So we keep ourselves engaged. We don't listen to the mind, therefore the mind can be the friend or the enemy. You just don't listen. The mind says so many things, I have greed, I have lust, I have envy. The mind's saying, act according to envy, act according to greed, act according. So we don't listen to the mind. We beat it with a shoe. In the morning you get up, you beat the mind 100 times with a shoe, and you eat before you go to bed, you beat it with a broomstick. That's what Back to the Note the Course says, right? The mind says so many things, but we don't act upon it. We beat the mind. Let the mind. The mind can go on like a madman. We'll just keep doing our service. That's how we deal with it.
And how do we respond when we feel that someone is envious
with us? We don't let that affect. Prabhupada mentions in the Bhagavad Gita, I think it's the third chapter he describes anything. We don't. It might be the 12th chapter. We don't allow another devotee's service. Envy means envy, being free from envy means we don't allow another devotee's service to influence our service. That's it. That's how we rise above envy coming at us or coming from our own mind. We don't allow another devotional service, because they're envious of us, affect our devotional service, and we don't allow our mind that may be affected by envy to affect our devotional service. Wherever it's coming from, we just don't allow. So we know. So for instance, say we're cooking something for the guru who's come to visit. We're cooking chapatis. Chapatis, they've got to be nice and hot, and you cook one and you whip them straight in there and rub a little butter and you get them in there as quick as you can, as soon as they're cooked. Some devotee comes in, they're envious. Oh, you're cooking for the, Guru Dev. I would have liked to have done that, and I think you're a rascal. I should be doing that. They get angry, And in their envy, they're like, they may do things to disturb you, They might try and distract you, make you burn your chapati, try and get, why don't you go and do this? I'll get someone else to come and do that. You look a bit tired. You don't even have time to argue with them. You're cooking your parties. You turn your head away for 5 minutes, you look back, it's black. You don't allow that to... You're doing your service. You just keep cooking those your parties, rub the butter on, he's going to love that one. You just keep getting them in there. You just don't allow your service to be interrupted, to be affected. As soon as you do, then... You've lost your strong position. As soon as you allow your service to be reduced, diminished, you've lost your strength, and Maya can get a very good grip upon you.
How do you deal with
You know, it's similar. You know, if you're fixed up in serving Krishna and his representatives in a way that's actually pleasing, you're protected from everything. Pride, envy, you know, the motive. You're protected from the modes of material nature. So we know that, you know, there are many qualities of the modes. There's pride and envy, you know, the modes of ignorance, is, you know, qualities of the mode of passion, qualities of the mode of goodness. If you're fixed in your devotional service, you're actually protected from the influence of all the modes of material nature. And therefore, in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 14th chapter, it describes that a devotee is not affected by the modes of material nature even when they're present. What's that verse? You know that verse?
22 and 25, is it?
Yeah, yeah. Very nice verse, you know. Even the modes of material nature are present. They can be present within our mind, our senses, coming at us from people around us. When the modes are strong and influencing, but a devotee is transcendental when they're not affected even though the modes are present. That means they're transcendently situated. And that's how one becomes a pure devotee even in the neophyte stage. Pure devotion means they're transcending everything, you know, they're protected. So even those things are present, you know, we remain neutral. How do you remain neutral? Because you're absorbed in your service. Mm-hmm. If you're not absorbed in your service, mentally, physically, you cannot be neutral to the modes of material nature. You must act, you must interact. So that's the secret.
Well, that means that literally
24
hours you have to be absorbed in
yourself. Yeah, but that's yeah. So that's like saying, well, you know, I have to be sane all the time. You know, that I'm accustomed to every now and then going a little bit insane. You're asking me to just remain sane permanently. So, it's a good thing. You always you make it sound like something, a little artificial.
It's difficult.
Yes, we've got ourselves in a mess because we have so many conditionings over millions of lifetimes that we take our normal position as something abnormal. Their abnormal position is something acceptable. Not that you should do this, but if you see the worm in stool, and you take the worm out of the stool, it will crawl straight back in there. That's our position. We're saying, always be situated on the platform of pure devotional service, you taking me out of the stool of material existence. We want to, you know, get straight back in. And that position is no different to the stool and the worm. It's a ludicrous position, but from the worm's position, it seems quite a sensible thing to do. Just using the same examples that Prabhupada uses when that pretty much the same comments are played, because these are especially if you listen to his conversations and his morning walks and what have you, there's a lot of interaction, and it's especially nice because the very questions that we tend to ask as devotees, all of those questions got asked. Probably there's no questions that they didn't ask Prabhupada. And if you actually go through them, you just get these wonderful
Actually, there's a thing that says that that's how we should train to answer your devotees. We should keep hearing Prabhupada.
Yeah.
see how he answered.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, Srila Prabhupada has taken those answers from Shastra, from the Acharya's commentaries on you know, the books, from his own spiritual master. They are, you know, approved examples for certain objections and questions that have been used, you know, since time immemorial, practically.
And the word they
use,
it is quite a punch.
Yeah.
Going on,
but
just to the point.
Yeah. It's like the we're discussing here about approaching God for some motivation. So, you know, we have examples of you know, people who approach God. Mention the Bhagavad Gita. We have Gajendra as an example of someone who approached the Lord to mitigate distress. That's the motivation. Dhruva Maharaj is an example of, in the beginning, there was some motivation. You approach in need of money and material opulence. The sages of Naimisharanya were, you know, approached to satisfy their inquisitiveness. And the four Kumaras approached, you know, for wisdom and knowledge like that. They're considered Kanishta Adhikaris, you know, when one approaches the Lord for those, you know, particular moods, you know, at that stage of their devotional service. So Dhruva Maharaj, of course, we know as a pure devotee, but in the beginning he approached the Lord as a Kanishta. But he then gave up those ways and, you know, become fixed in the pure devotional mood. Now, you know, we stated in Bhakti Shastri that they're not qualified for pure devotional service because they're approaching the Lord for some material benefit, except for the wise man, the Kumaras. There's some, you know, borderline, so we won't go into that too much now. But the tendency is that one can leave or diminish one's devotional service when one's desire is fulfilled.
That's mainly with the first two, isn't it? With those
in
distress or those in need of money.
But the inquisitive also can be there. But particularly those, yeah. But if they have the association, if they come in that mood of mixed devotional service, but they associate with pure devotees, they would then take up pure devotional service. An example that we can use is that Prabhupada gives the example of the old lady who was carrying sticks, you know, on her head, and she used to pray to God to, you know, that she was so sad that she was materially impoverished, and she wanted God to increase her, you know, opulence. And one day the bundle of sticks fell from her head, and she prayed to God, "Oh, this is so difficult, please help me, please help me." And then God actually appeared before her and you know, said, "Yes, you know, I can fulfill your desire." And she said, "Yes, you please place this bundle of sticks, help me get them back on my head." So, you know, it's an example that shows the foolishness of approaching God for some particular materially motivated, you know, request. It's a very foolish thing to do. It's actually better to, you know, approach Him in pure devotional service. So many people come to Krishna consciousness as a mixed devotee in the Kanishta stage, but by associating with devotees, they see that there's a certain amount of foolishness about approaching God like that, and it's better to give up those motivations and just serve Him for His pleasure at that.
Yeah. Yes. He said that even though he was so elevated, But I know I'm foolish to be asking this of you.
Mm.
But I have this desire. So, though, of course, this is an extreme example for the sticks on my head.
Mm. So, what is the question?
That is, two thoughts came to my mind. That to a certain extent, she had material desires. She could not approach the Lord at that point, though her cry was so much.
Mm.
Number two, like they say that Krishna himself is remembrance and forgetfulness.
Mm.
So she could not think of anything else.
Yeah.
She could not see, though he was Krishna, she could not see him as Krishna, as a supreme Lord.
So, you know, Kadama Muni wanted to practice pure devotional service. And, you know, he understood that he'd be better situated to, you know, practice pure devotional service, you know, if there was a little help in that regard from the Lord. So, you know, his motivation was actually to, you know, perform pure devotional service, which he actually became, you know. So, you know, that's a little different scenario that someone is approaching the Lord. The motivation is not that ultimately I'll become a pure, you know, take up pure devotional service. I just want the wife, or I just want the husband, or I just want the money. You know. You know. So, you know, sometimes we see that devotees need a little material assistance from Krishna because they know that, you know, it gives them a little bit of more strength than what they have to be in it for the long run, to, you know, actually perform pure devotional service, which is their real goal. So, you know, that's okay. It's different from people who don't have that goal of pure devotional service at all. They just want the benefit, and, you know, when they get that, they're quite happy to go away.
But then, even if you cry once, so, for the Lord, so much so that the Lord comes in front of you, that itself should be purifying. So, if that story is a true story, or just to teach us a lesson, that's a different story. But it could be some stories that they meant just to teach us a lesson, that this is what we are doing. But otherwise, just calling for the Lord once, that way, so that the Lord comes in front of us, that itself is takes us back home to Godhead. So that lady has cried and that for Krishna.
Yes.
That itself is great. She has seen Krishna.
Well, yeah, I've never heard the end of that story. I don't know what happened to that old lady, whether she, you know, eventually said, you know, whether she understood it was foolish. I've never heard the end of the story. Prabhupada doesn't tell it. It tells the foolishness of approaching the Lord like that. But she may have, you know, then...
That's the aim of
we don't know. So therefore, from Dhruva Maharaj, we understand it's a very similar situation. He approached the Lord almost like that lady, you know, yes, you give me some, you know, benefit like that. But then, by association of devotees of the Lord, they give it up and take it, you know. So we understand the ending of that story basically, you know, through Dhruva Maharaj, but... We also understanding that, you know, that story is a little bit open in the sense that if that's her only purpose, then she really is foolish.
Mm-hmm.
But, and sometimes you'll be surprised that people come before the deities, they see Radha and Krishna and Jagannath and Korn and Thai, they associate with devotees, they have Vishad and they chant Hare Krishna, but they come here to pray for some material benefit, and really when they get that, they, you know, go away. They're not interested in anything else. So, you know, they have
that. It's basically what your intention is, what your goal is. If your ultimate goal is
Krishna, will not
please Krishna.
Yeah, Krishna will not interfere. You know, that. I mean, he's giving all opportunity, you know, as far as possible, that anyone, as you're saying, in the world, they can come to the ISKCON, they can have prasadam, you know, and you know, a nice service, and they can literally give up the process of working hard like an ass in the material world, and just sing and dance, and you know, go back to body. Anyone can do that. That opportunity is, but you know, if they're determined to do something else, just to remain in the material world and approach God just to fulfill some, you know, if they're determined, he'll not interfere with that. That's the determination. Now, so it was very good, nice discussion. I think we covered a lot of important points on that subject matter. There's a lot of many of the different aspects of this chapter are covered in the Purva Svadvaya questions. And we can cover that when we do a revision. You know, we can go over some of those things when we do a revision. So I'm pretty happy there. But what I'd like to say, I'll just pass around the sheets to sign that. So there's a retreat on next week. Is that correct? And so in 2 weeks' time, we're going to come along here and have a revision. We can turn this off now.